excited for some awesome stories. But I'm gonna, before we get started, why don't we go through here, starting over here with Zach Penn, the director. I'm gonna let each of the panelists introduce themselves. Seriously, this is a legendary video game panel, so I'm gonna let Zach get started right now. This is his baby.
I'm Zach Penn, I'm the director.
Mike.
I don't know if I'm legendary from a video game
you
perspective.
Will be.
You will be.
Other than playing a lot of video games, but mostly a writer and director.
I'm Howard Scott Warshaw. I made some video games.
That's being very kind. Yes, you did. Anyway, next.
I'm Nolan Bushnell.
Jonathan Chin, one of the executive producers of the Atari film for Lightbox.
My name is Simon Chin. It's no coincidence that we share the same slightly weird last name because we're cousins, and I'm also one of the executive producers of this film.
I'm Joe Lewandowski. I find very video games.
Mike Burns from Fuel, and just a producer on the show, and brought this idea to these guys.
Okay, so first of all, let me say, actually, the first thing I want to do is, Nolan, Howard's already got one, but we snagged you an ET cartridge. And they're not easy to come by, as Joe will tell you at some point. I actually wanted to get that out of the way because the smell of the dig and those cartridges, literally, I mean, I would probably vomit, and that would cause everyone else to vomit, so I had to get it out of my pocket. We are going to do, people might know this already, tonight we're going to screen the movie, which I guess is officially being announced right now at this moment. So at the end of this panel, we will announce the details and tell you guys where to go if you want to come see it. I hope you like it. We're not completely finished yet, but it's in good enough shape to show you. Before we start the panel, we're going to show you a clip from the movie. Now, this is just, you know, a random four-minute section of the movie that kind of tees up some of the history that's involved. So. It's not a trailer, it's just something to kind of put it in perspective for those of you who don't know anything about Atari or video games or movies.
All right, let's drop the lights and roll the clip.
Atari, where the future comes from.
What excited me about Atari wasn't Pong, it was the chipset that led to the Atari 2600. Pong was sort of okay, you bang up and back and up and back. But this meant you could constantly change the games, and that was a very exciting idea to me. We introduced the 2600 in 1977 with 9 cartridges. The home video game was a very close approximation of the coin-op experience.
It changed the mindset of the world.
Turning the television from a passive medium into an active medium, that was what we knew we were doing, and that was super exciting to be the pioneers in that field. It just blew people away.
Nobody knew any of this stuff. They made it up as they went, and they were good at it, and it started everything.
It was playing those games that taught people the potential of a computer. Atari, at some level, brought the computer revolution.
They started experimentally hiring smart kids with this idea that maybe they could come up with other stuff to do. And they inadvertently were trying to create the job of game designer.
Microprocessor real-time control programming is just where it's at. So there's two kinds of things you could typically do with that in the early 1980s. You can do missile guidance systems, or like we say, kill people for 12 cents a head. Or you can make video games, which I thought was a much better application for the whole thing.
What went on at Atari from the very beginning was basically that the engineers are going to drive this company, because they weren't just engineers, they were creative guys. They're like musicians or movie directors, they're artists.
Through luck or providence or both, they ended up with this department of game designers that became this dream team at Atari. These guys who made all of these classics, Tempest and Asteroids and Centipede and Gauntlet, you know, think of a game.
The culture was these guys knew what they wanted. One day I was standing at the men's room at a urinal and I looked down and I saw a pair of bare feet next to me. And I looked and here is a guy wearing a pair of shorts and nothing else. And I said something and they said, oh yeah, that's so-and-so, he's a great engineer. He doesn't like to wear clothes. The coin-op engineers at Atari, they were great. And on the consumer side, Howard was one of the best programmers. He was one of the best of those engineers.
At the heart of the creative process is the programmer.
I try to create basically a sensory experience that evokes a certain feeling in the user. I mean, I tend to program from the concept. I mean, I was made for this. I mean, this was what I was made to do. January 11th, 1981, I showed up for my first day of work as a game programmer at Atari.
So do you remember the first day you showed up here?
Absolutely. My first office mates were Todd Fry and Rob Zadibble. And I had an understanding that there was a lot of dope that was smoked at Atari when we were there. And so on my first day at work, I brought a joint because I didn't want to be, you know, I wanted to be a courteous guest. And so,
which, by the way, this is a good lesson for our younger viewers. If people are doing drugs, bring your own so you fit in.
Todd walks in, shuts the door, and says, I'm going to get high in here, so if you don't want to be around this, you better leave. No, actually, here, I said, I brought a joint. And he sort of looked at me and went, I'm going to smoke some real stuff. Okay. That was my introduction. That was my first day at work.
Oh, yeah. You guys want to see more of that, don't you? So that was, again, we're going to give details later on where you can see the entire film, right?
Yes.
As it exists right now.
Oh, no, it's just going to be that clip over and over.
So, Zach, I want to start with you and talk about where did you come up with this idea? Tell us, take us on this journey from the concept to the idea to what we're going to see tonight.
Well, I didn't come up with this idea. It's a good place to start. Actually, I was asked to direct the movie after the guys from Fuel had already done a lot of research about it, and after the people at Xbox had already, I guess, bought the idea, and after the guys at Lightbox had already started, you know, putting together the plan for doing it. So it was really something where I had lunch with Simon and Jonathan and Jada Miranda, an executive, Simon wasn't there, he was in England at the time, but he was there in spirit or on the phone. And they basically said, hey, do you want to do a movie about Atari? And the great I said, yes, I'll do it. Done. Just because I grew up with Atari, I love the idea of it, I love documentaries, and that's it.
Easiest pitch ever?
Very easy pitch, and I wish I could take credit for the idea, but I can only take credit for getting my name on the front of it. So
we're going to step back a little bit, and I want to go to Nolan. Nolan, talk to us a little bit about the early success of Atari, the 2600 launch. Before you came in here, I asked everybody, could you put your hands up, everyone that had 2600? I mean, look at that. Tell us a little bit about the 2600 launch and what you consider, why it has such a lasting legacy.
Well, first of all, it was a time, remember that the 6502 had not been invented until 1976. The microprocessor itself had not been invented until 1974. And that was a 4-bit slice. And so this was really at the infancy of the whole microprocessor revolution. And we wanted to make a game that could play a whole bunch of different games. We thought if we really squeezed it hard, 16, maybe 20 games out of the hardware. Of course, the brilliance of software is that, you know, several hundred cartridges later is there. And we basically shipped the product. We made a, you know, I can remember making a major mistake, and I thought that we'd only sell about 3 cartridges per console. And so all of a sudden, everybody who bought the 2600 bought every one of the cartridges except for Basic Man. That was not it.
And there's the problem in America today, right?
And so as a result, we had all these consoles out that only had the cartridge that was shipped with it. And of course, we put in as fast as we could. In those days, they were mass ROMs, so to turn them around was about 3 months. So we left a lot of money on the table.
Tell us about the role of the engineer at Atari.
The engineer was the rock star, was the god. We, the center of gravity of the company was egalitarian. This was right after the summer of Rome. This was, we wanted to create a meritocracy. And the meritocracy said, hey, we're all in this together. No reserved parking spots. We all eat in the same lunchroom, and we work hard, and we play even harder. And so we would have beer busts for hitting quotas, and we would have a lot of fun. The workforce was very young. We had we probably had an average age group of somewhere between 22 and 24. All the executives were in their late 20s, early 30s.
So the young group.
It was a young group, and the engineers, many of which were not college graduates. I mean, the guy who was the primary architect of the 2600 was a high school dropout, self-taught, very brilliant, very capable.
Wow. Great. Now, so
everyone should drop out of school.
Right? More lessons.
I worked with a college dropout, Bill Gates.
Yeah.
Howard, I want to talk. We saw a little bit about your first day at Atari at that clip. Tell us about how you came to Atari. What brought you there?
What brought me to Atari was a guy I was working with at HP. I actually did go to college, and after college I started working at Hewlett Packard, which is something I like to think of as a software pasture where programmers go to die. It was a very boring place for me, and I would kind of have a I was the antics guy in my division at HP, and one of my coworkers said one day, you know, I was telling my wife a Howard story the other day, and she said, that's just like what goes on where she works. I said, well, where's that? She said, it's this place called Atari. So I thought, that's a place maybe I should work. So I went, and I interviewed, and I dressed up, and I put on my nice jacket and stuff, because I want to make a professional appearance. And then they told me, you know, it seems like you're really well suited for this, except we think you're a little too straight for our organization. And so I literally begged my way in.
So that was a challenge to you, you're like, straight. You want to be in there, right?
I wanted to be there. I said, I think you're really making a big mistake. I said, I think I would fit into your environment a lot better than you're thinking. I said, this is the work I need to do. When I was in college, I was working on microprocessors, and that was very rare for people in college. And so I came out, and then I wasn't doing that anymore. And games were nice. I didn't realize how much I'd love making video games until I got there. The reason I went to Atari was I liked working on microprocessors, this really intricate, difficult challenge. The idea that this could tickle the creative side of me was an amazing bonus in my life.
Now, Howard, also, I want to point something out, is that it was much different back then than it is today, where people can go and kind of learn how to code. The development that you were doing back then, very different. Like, you were writing to the metal, as we say in business.
Very different, you know. Nowadays, people have bitmaps, and they have all kinds of libraries to help them control the sprites and things that are running around. We were literally programming the electron beam as it moved across the screen. So you only had to be accurate to the microsecond. Every line, 192 times down the screen. It was a very interesting challenge, but it was fun. That was the game. The game was making a game.
Zach, I want to, as you've been developing this, the film, tell us about what you uncovered. We'll talk about that later. But what you uncovered about the Atari impact on pop culture.
Well, first of all, look at this right here, right? Yeah. No, well, by the way, I grew up on Atari. I was just telling Nolan before that my dad got Pong the day it came out, pretty much, and I was probably the first generation to start playing video games when I was 5 years old, and you know, never stopped since. So I knew as a kid we were all obsessed with Atari. I mean, that was our lives. You know, that's that and comic books, frankly, was the two things my parents told me never to get involved with. I'd never make a career out of it. So I knew even from my own childhood how important Atari was and the kind of influence it had on the culture. What I didn't realize, which was very refreshing, and I think you'll see in the movie, is how much the fandom, in the same way that the fandom of comic books is really, I mean, they know their stuff. You know, it's not like, there's not, as everyone who goes to Comic-Con knows, they're not amateurs. They'll start quoting, well, no, you know, that's not what Storm did. She actually lived in Cairo and whatever. When it comes to video games, I've been really impressed how much people really understand how important this was to the development of video games, how primal it was. You know, the idea that, you know, Asteroids is a game that's still fun to play. It's kind of a perfectly designed game, and that's relevant. It's not just like, you know, Call of Duty popped out of nowhere, that there's a history to all this. And I have to say, that's what really took me by surprise, is not so much the influence it had on the culture then, but it's the fact that all these people are here now and actually follow what Howard's saying about, you know, the electron, you know, firing across the screen is pretty impressive. So that was definitely a surprise, and it kind of led us down this very different path, which I don't want to give away too much about. It's in the movie.
Now, we've got, if we can flip to the next slide, I think we've got some stuff here we're going to do. Can you put up the hashtag slide? There we go. Digging ET. So, what do you say we give one of these away?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so you guys need to pop open your phones, use the hashtag, tell us what you think about this. We'll choose a winner at the end, and you will actually win one of these guys. But you have to promise me you won't open it until you get outside, because it stinks. Okay.
Yeah, he knows. Because that's an ET game. Right. Yeah, so this is... There were not, I mean, these are actually pretty hard to come by for those of you who are interested, so believe me.
So this is actually kind of cool. So pop open your phones and do that. Use Digging ET, and we'll be looking for those. All right, we want to get into the actual game development right now and then the burial. Howard, tell us, I mean, you've talked about it a little bit publicly, but I want to talk about the development of the ET game itself, the unbelievable timeline, your interaction with Steven Spielberg, and then kind of the life cycle of it.
Well, it won't take long to talk about the life cycle of E.T. E.T., I think it still stands as the fastest video game ever developed in history, in the long history of video games. But it started with sitting in my office in an afternoon and got a call from the CEO of Atari, which never happens. And I said, hey, we need E.T. for September 1st, and this was July 27th. And he goes, can you do it? I said, yeah, I can do that, because I knew I needed to do it. And I think we do a pretty, my understanding is there's a whole coverage of this in the movie tonight. It was a very intense 5 weeks. It was a very intense 5 weeks. And so I worked and I worked and I worked. And it was life-altering then. And it was just so nice to be done with it at the end. And then one day, Steven Spielberg showed up at Atari, played a little of the game and said, okay. And that was, but it was probably the most intense 5 weeks of my life, I'd probably say. And,
but I want to, real quick, I mean, nowadays we're dealing with, you know, studios that have 100 person development, like you talked about Call of Duty or maybe 200.
Okay.
Let's talk about, you were the designer. Yeah, let's talk about that.
Okay, so E.T. had a programmer, had a game designer, graphics designer, had a sound person, and I had one guy who did the graphics. I had somebody who did that intro, and I was the rest of the people. That was it. It was one person doing.
Was that normal back in the day? one says yes.
Normal is a very interesting concept at Atari. Okay. It was normal for a game to have one programmer. It was also normal for that programmer to have 6 to 8 months to do the game. So doing this in 5 weeks, it's pretty intense.
Yeah.
Pretty intense. So would you have given somebody 5 weeks to do a game?
No. Well, it's a thing where you can put 9 women to have a baby in a month, but it's not a very good baby.
And there's the quote. All right, well. Zach, I want to talk about, we're going to get to some of the other panels in just a moment, but the game's impact on the video game industry that you uncovered as you were starting to research the story here.
Well, actually, you know, one thing that I really don't, it really is at the heart of the movie is, you know, one of the things that really interested me was how this legend, you know, there's a whole legend, which is E.T. was made, it came out, it destroyed the video game industry for 3 years. It did so badly that the whole video game industry, including, you know, Atari was the video game industry, collapsed for a number of years until it finally bounced back. And it was so bad that Atari buried it. I mean, that's the legend that people tell. And the movie is kind of a systematic deconstruction of that legend. So I don't want to get into too much detail, but what I'd say is none of that is accurate. I mean, there's an element of truth of each of those parts, but it's all jumbled up. And one of the big discoveries for me was figuring out, oh, wait, how is this burial related to what happened with the returns of E.T., and how is that related to what happened with Atari? How did it turn into this crazy urban legend? You know,
right.
Which, you know, you guys probably all know, is not a legend. You know, so a friend of mine said, a legend is supposed to be untrue. You know, an urban legend is. So, yeah, I mean, that really became the story of the movie, was figuring out what actually happened.
But one of the things that really did happen is this had quite an impact on your life, Howard, didn't it? Can you tell us what happened after you know, kind of your exit from the industry, as it were?
Well, I didn't leave because of it. But, no, I mean, I had done Yar's Revenge, and I had done Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I was doing pretty well, I thought. I really was very happy as a game maker, and then the E.T. challenge came up, but it was a different kind of challenge. It was a getting it done thing. And I did what I could. It was an amazing, intense effort. But by the same token, I always realized that players, it doesn't matter what went into making the game, it's what comes out on their screen, and that's what they're going to respond to. But people weren't that happy with the game, it turned out. And as time went on, I'd hear more and more of that. So that was kind of intense, but and we'll discuss a lot of this in the film, but it's my take on it is very different from what most people's take on it, because my experience of doing E.T. and what happened with it are very different. For me, there was 5 just ridiculously intense weeks of putting everything of myself into this product. And then there was this stuff that went on in papers and magazines and stuff like this about people talking about it here and there, and I was busy working on another game at that point. Not quite the same focus, but a lot. So it was a little more arm's length. But then again, this kind of talk has gone on for 3 decades, and, you know, this kind of stuff. So it's interesting to hear that over time. But to sum it up, I'm proud to have done the worst video game of all time.
And I want to go down to the end with Jonathan and Simon from Lightbox. You guys are the executive producers. Tell us about how you guys got involved and talk about this, the legend that we just spoke of. And you're like, wow, this is a great idea.
Yeah, well, we were talking to Xbox Studios about doing a series of films about the digital revolution. And they actually pitched us, Simon and I, the idea of this film, and neither of us are really gamers. I know that's probably not the right thing to say to this crowd, but you know, I think our first reaction was it felt like quite a niche story, and we had to sort of go back and do some research and dig into it. But shortly after doing that, I think you know, we came upon Howard and Nolan, and we started to put the pieces together in our heads about what an important story this actually is and what it says about technology and digital revolution. And I think after a little bit of time, we really saw how this could fit into the series that we were doing. So, you know, the legend itself, you know, our research showed it popped up in popular culture a lot, and it was one of those things that I just didn't know about. But you know when you sort of hear something and then that everybody knows except you, and then you find out and then you see it everywhere. It was one of those things. It was just sort of once I had heard the story, it seemed that wherever I looked, somebody was talking about it, and even a little research sort of showed that this was a story that had sort of gone on for 30 years. So from a filmmaking standpoint, a narrative standpoint, I mean, the idea of an unsolved legend that had survived for 30 years, I think was quite appealing. We signed up to do it. Here we are.
Nolan, I want to talk to you a little bit about why you think the games would have been better. First of all, talk about your role at Atari and kind of set the table for us there.
Well, I founded Atari and grew it in 1976, we had designed the 2600, and in doing the numbers, we just needed a massive amount of capital to launch it into the marketplace. And we were planning to take the company public to raise, in those days, I think we were going to raise $12 million. And the $12 million would get us launched into the marketplace. And then the stock market kind of went sideways. And so we had this wonderful product, and without enough money to really bring it into the marketplace in the right way. We had to build a factory. In fact, we'd already started to build a factory. And we were building hardware at the time, as well as software. And just couldn't get the math to work. And so we decided we needed a corporate partner. And the partner turned out to be Warner, and they wanted to buy the whole company. And, you know, between a rock and a hard place, I decided, okay, let's do it.
Okay.
And what we, you know, the sales pitch from Warner is that we leave everybody alone. And, of course, it was a lie. You know, and literally from almost the day Warner got involved, it was a fight. Because they had very different ideas about how the world should be structured. And we wanted a very egalitarian management structure, very, very horizontal management structure, not a lot of managers, not a lot of structure. And slowly but surely, they were a pain in the ass to me, and I was a pain in the ass to them, until I quit. No, you're fired. No, I it was one of those things. And we parted company, and so I left in 1978, and the 2600 was doing very, very well, and they brought in guys who were not gamers, didn't understand the business. And
see what happens when that happens.
And fundamentally dismantled the corporate culture, which I thought was the magic of what made Atari as wonderful as I think it was.
Why do you think these games were sent out to the desert to be buried?
I think that the people who aren't gamers get driven by different ideas, particularly at Hollywood, and they felt that they could put sort of a kiss and a promise on unrealistic schedules and build a game that makes sense because of the license. Now, they paid a massive license to Spielberg for that. And so the amount of money they spent for the license drove the number of cartridges they had to sell. And so instead of looking at market demand, it was market push,
right,
based on the deal they cut. And since they were all brilliant people who understood the ability to do they were they way overbuilt it, and when it turned out that the marketplace didn't like the game, when I first saw the game, I had my sources in Atari, even though I was doing Chuck E. Cheese at the time. I got one of the E-Proms, remember those puppies? And I plugged it in, I said, well, you know, this clearly is not finished.
Awkward.
It could have used another 48 hours.
and so, you know, and that was kind of the way I saw it. But it was, you know, when I heard out how much time it was, you know, it was, I thought it was impossible to do any kind of a game in 5 weeks, let alone six.
But it was five.
What's the same? All right, 5 weeks in a day, right?
We're going to go down to the other end of the table here. We'll talk to Joe Lewandowski, who was the Dig manager. Now, Joe, you, let me get this straight. You track garbage. Is that accurate?
Well, I've been in the business for 30 years.
Okay. But you were involved with the original Dig. We'll talk about what you're involved in here.
Well, basically, my involvement was I was 26 back then. I had our own solid waste company in that southern New Mexico, and we'd be the largest garbage company. And it was a whole industry just like the video industry, the game industry. It was all very innocent back then. So we just beat this big garbage company, and they agreed to sell out to us in August of '83. The Atari thing out happened in September of '83. The company decided they might make some money on the way out of town, but we weren't taken over until January 1st of '84. But so what happened was they kind of sneaked this in to make some money on the way. And there's all kinds of things on the web. It was interesting how it came out, especially when you were there. One of the drivers came and said, you should see what's going on at the dump. And I went out there and looked. And, oh, okay, a bunch of games. I thought it was silly. Somebody would be throwing away brand new games, cases, you know, pallets and pallets and tons of them. But I was too busy making a living going back to work. So I had to get back to work. So to me, I was not a gamer. It was the same thing. So it was, that's what happened in '83. And I forgot all
about. But were you just there and you're like, here come all these games that they're gonna get destroyed or buried? And did anybody ask why?
No, not really. we were enjoying them too much because everybody in Otero County in southern New Mexico had them because they were all over the place. They were going out as fast as they were coming in.
Right. Now, did you witness actually trucks like coming down the highway? And
oh yeah, there were the big trucks, semi trucks, and so on.
Right.
The city, you know, again, had no knowledge it was happening. It was one of these. It wasn't in the middle of the night like some say, and it was fun to read because 4 years ago. People would ask me about it all the time. Did this really happen? Because the legend got so big. I never thought anything of it. So I
had to read the web to know that it was taking on a life of its own.
I was still too busy. You know, I'd never checked to see what was going on with it until I started getting calls from production companies, including Fuel and so on. And it's like, what's the big deal? And then when I went online and looked for it, and 3 million hits, and I'm like, really? These 3 million people don't have much of a life. It's garbage. I mean, come on. But then as I read, it was quite interesting how it turned. And I think it was the denials that it ever happened by Atari. It was the things that went on. All these things that happened. They built the story. Sometimes the denial was bigger than the story.
Yeah.
And that's what happened here on a lot of it. And then it was interesting to read all the experts because you could tell clearly these people had never been here. I liked some of the blogs that saying it's in a barren part of this country that not even Steven Spielberg would not venture. Elm Gore's not that bad if you ever want to go there.
Just avoid the landfill.
So, yeah, but
the landfill's pretty nice, actually. And until we dug it up, it's a pretty pleasant place to hang out. You'd be surprised.
Except for the smell.
No, it smells great up there, actually, until you dig up the games, and then
Armageddon happens.
So that's kind of how it started and what went on with it. Again, until 4 years ago, I didn't realize it had turned into the legend and the stories that were out there. And that's what gave the challenge, could this actually be found? But it's not like today. We're far more sophisticated in our industry as the gaming industry is. We we GPS everything now. That's how you can find dead bodies. You can find all kinds of stuff in a dump. Yeah, they were wondering why everything is tracked these days. Back then, it was dig a hole, put it in there, cover it up, and go home. So,
real quick, Mike down there from Fuel, you're the you're involved with this. You're the producer. Tell us about how you heard about the legend, how you wanted to get involved, and kind of working with the city, because you had to go down there and say, hey, we're coming in to dig stuff up.
Yeah, you know, and like Zach, I had an Atari when I was 6 or 7 years old, and changed my life. I kind of went from living outside, playing with all my buddies, to living in my parents' basement for many years to come. And, we were in a meeting a few years ago with a lady, and we kind of found out that she was involved in the first licensing deal, a few of the first licensing deals in video gaming, and I just, it kicked into my head, because I heard about it, but, this happened so long ago. It's not like now when something happens to a company, it's, tweeted about by the staff as it's happened, and all that content and information is just readily available. So, people have speculated what happened to Atari, and was this part of it? And so that's always been in the back of my mind, and there was never really any hard proof of what it was. So, I have an ad agency, digital agency that does gaming, and a lot of the guys there were like, man, we got to really dig into this and see what we can come up with and see if we can find them. And so we put Daniel on that, on tracking down the land site, the landfill sites that might have it. And, he, through his diligence and a year and a half of banging on doors, he came across Joe. And, it took a long time to kind of work through a lot of the details and the contracting and the nagging. And you can imagine a small city with, incredible people, but not everybody's a full-time, working at the city as a politician, or sometimes they're running different businesses on the side. And, so it's getting through that process and making it happen quickly was, a bit of a hurdle.
Because I want to be clear, it's not like you guys can just go out and say, it's about here, let's start digging. There's lot of EPA regulations.
Environmental issues, everything like that we had to go through. And so it took us a while to get those rights, and we ended up getting them. And we didn't really anticipate to get media coverage right away, but I guess there was a local reporter wrote about a meeting at City Hall when it got approved and we were granted the rights. And man, that blew up. It just one little guy's blog just got picked up, and it just blew up worldwide. And our phones, all our voicemails were filled from people from South Africa and Japan and Ireland and Canada and everywhere calling us. And a lot of people just calling us and saying, hey, I got a cartridge. You don't have to go dig them under the ground. But it was nice because it, right away it validated, man, people care about Atari, care about what happened. And we just knew there was a great story to tell. So that's when we packaged it up and we went and pitched it to a few people in Microsoft. They just jumped on it, and that's when we brought these guys on board.
Joe, I want to ask you, you talked about you remember this. How did you know where to dig? Like, they're definitely here. Can you give, real quickly, can you tell us about that?
But don't give away too much, because that's a lot of that's in the movie.
I already got that. There was not, as I was saying, in industry today, if you're looking for something, it's elevations and GPS's tracks. I mean, something that's buried in 2008, we can go right to it today. Back then, you couldn't. So it was that was what got me involved. I was not a gamer. I was thinking, I just never got into the gaming. I never had time to get into the gaming. It was the challenge. So this was almost like a video game of my own, the treasure hunt.
That was your quest.
Yeah. Well, basically, I don't think there's anybody in this room that wouldn't want to go look for a treasure and find that treasure. And that's what it turned into me. And then as I went through it, it got bigger and bigger and harder and harder. I built million-dollar landfills with less hassle than it took to dig up these little It was unreal what it was. And it's almost like they didn't want to come out of the ground. I mean, it was one of those things. So to find it was not to simply go stand on it and find it. I mean, it was, because we're talking about hundreds of acres, an area of probably about 30 feet by about 80 feet wide, 30 feet down, somewhere in those hundreds of acres, with no tracking, no documentation, no paperwork, no GPS track, no surveys, nothing. So, and the terrain had changed in 30-some years. So, the movie explains how that was happening. It's quite interesting how it was done. But it was one of those treasure hunts that all of you would dream that, like, I'd love to be on this treasure hunt. Could I really make it? And then as people kept saying, you'll never find them, you'll never find them. It just made stronger when you had to find them.
Yeah, and just to throw it out there, I mean, I figured when I was told about it, oh, yeah, these guys know where the games are.
my immediate reaction is, what the hell did I get involved with? How's this happening? You know, I really thought we're never going to find these. It seems impossible. How do I get off this project? For a while, I was just very nervous, thinking, this, I better come up with something funny, because this is going to be a really boring movie.
I remember being out there with you, and you were sweating.
Yeah, we were sweating. Well, we were sweating also for other reasons. But yeah, no, it was definitely, it's pretty shocking how much effort it takes, you know, to find something like this.
Yeah, oh. Exactly. And that, you know, by the part of the stress part, like I said, at the end there, as that excavator got deeper and deeper, I got more and more stressed, and I was looking around at all these people and all the money that was being spent. And I've never moonwalked in my life, but I was trying to figure out if I could moonwalk in reverse and kind of disappear before anybody realized we didn't find them. But luckily we did.
We're gonna continue here. We're going to cue some people up. We don't have a lot of time, but we want to ask some questions, so go ahead and jump up there. How much time do I have left? Roughly? 10 minutes, great. We've got 10 minutes for questions, and then we're going to announce at the end of that where the screening's tonight. We'll give this little puppy away. First, right here. What's your name?
My name's Ryan Short.
Hi there. Which question?
Well, I was at the dig, and I run a children's charity that puts video games in children's hospitals, and I brought an Atari 2600 with the dust jacket that I was hoping that Nolan and Howard could sign for a charity auction.
Yeah, we'll go ahead and do that. I'm gonna tell you where you can meet up with those guys later. I'm sure they'll
have
it.
I do have a question.
Yes.
Have any of you heard from the Space Museum about when those are going to be auctioned off, whatever the ones that are left?
Yeah, they're not going to be auctioned.
Where can we buy one?
You know, Joe will have answers for you eventually about how you can get a game, but he's not going to tell you right now. Maybe if you come to the signing thing afterwards, he'll
We'll be doing a signing right after this. I'll give you details.
Okay.
Thank you. Next question. What's your name?
Tristan.
Hi, Tristan.
Well, I've read stuff about the urban legend myself, hearing, like, there has been, like, confirmed news articles from back in the day about they did do actually bury those cartridges.
These are guys right here. Everybody knows.
Right. Yeah. The question is, like, what would we... Give an answer.
That's okay.
It's a really difficult question to ask, because, like, I have to put it in context and all that.
What would lead people to think that they weren't there? Is that what you were going to ask?
Yeah, and what... And would that lead to why it was necessary to go do the dig that you did for the movie?
Yeah, well, that is a good... I know what you're talking about, and by the way, it was hard to express that in the movie as well. It's true, because why wouldn't... What's not to believe? You know, I mean, I did a movie at Loch Ness. There is a lot of reasons not to believe in the Loch Ness Monster, I can tell you. Why wouldn't a company throw their garbage in a garbage dump? You know, that was a question that came up quite a bit, you know, when I was talking. And by the way, there's a lot of people who are still very skeptical. I mean, there's a lot of conspiracy theorists who believe that we didn't actually do this. I believe I've been telling people that they're all in television cartridges that we doctored to look at.
One reason people might not believe in the legend, because I've been denying it for 30 years myself. I've been interviewed so many times, and I've always said, no, there's no way Atari shipped these cars way out in the desert and buried them there, because it doesn't make any sense, right? What company that's failing financially spends extra money to go get rid of a product that's so worthless they want to dump it, right? But the thing is, with Atari, if once you start to expect them to make sense, you're totally losing touch with Atari.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was very difficult.
Next question.
Hi, guys. It's great to see you here again. Good to see Howard and Nolan as well again. Met you before at Classic Gaming Expo in Vegas a few times. I always believed that something was buried out in the desert. I've been one of these people that thought, yes, there is something there. It's a question of what was actually there. So I've been very interested in seeing all the documentary coming along, all the footage from the dig up. So it's very good to see that it's justified, that my faith has actually been rewarded over the course of the last 20 years. So my question is, touching on something Howard said, I've played just about every single Atari 2600 game. E.T. and Pac-Man, which is another game blamed for the crash, nowhere near the worst Atari 2600 game ever programmed. I can reel off a whole list of ones far, far worse than both of those. So my question to everyone on the panel is, what is the worst video game you have ever played?
I'm going to pass on that one.
The worst... This is a part of the movie, but I will tell you that the Last Action Hero video game, which is the first script I ever wrote, was Last Action Hero, and the video game for that is really unbearable.
On the Super Nintendo.
I believe it was Super Nintendo. I mean, I feel like there's even a handheld version, but it was terrible. Howard?
For me, honestly, it would probably have to be the Charlie's Angels game. I played that, I think, on GameCube or something. That was... You want to talk about a game that was not finished? Oh, and I'll bet they had more than one person working on that game.
I always had a box of EEPROMs that were stuffed, and I lost track of the ones that made it into the market versus the ones that...
Nolan's living in an alternate universe.
Exactly. And I would say that half of the ones that I had in the shoebox were fundamentally unplayable. I mean, like, you'd say, what were they trying to have me do? I mean, how do you score? How do you win? What's the objective? You know, that's a really bad game. You can't come up with those answers.
I think we're going to announce the screening, right?
Yes.
Okay, so why don't you do
that? Why don't we go ahead? We've got a slide up here. Let's flip it up to the next slide. And so get your phones out. You're going to want to take a picture of this. Let's go to show where the screening is. Tim, can we bring that up?
Thank you for the question, by the way.
Yeah, it was an awesome question.
Guys, we won't make the guys who
don't tell anybody that it's not the worst game of all time.
So, Reading Cinema's Gas Lamp, number 15, 8 o'clock tonight. You're going to want to get there early, okay? Seating's going to be limited, first come, first serve, so take a look at that. And also, right after this, we're going to be over in the Xbox Lounge doing a signing. Next question.
Cheers, guys.
Thank you.
Hi, what's your name?
Hi, my name is Rachel.
Hi, Rachel.
Hi. I wanted to know, what have you found the most, what have you found the least, and what's the most unusual thing that you found in the landfill?
Okay, well, some of this I'm going to save for the movie, because that is kind of the mystery of what exactly we found. I would say, what did we find the most of? Well, it's hard for me to answer any of those questions without blowing one of the twists in the movie. I will tell you that my favorite game, and love these guys' games, but was Adventure when I was a kid. And a number of people in the movie, Ernie Klein, who wrote Ready Player One, mentioned as well. For us, Adventure was a game that really blew our minds, and I snagged a copy of it, which I have framed. So that was, and there were very few adventures in that pile. So I won't tell you what there were the most of, but that there were the fewest of, I believe. And a bowling ball. We found a bowling ball
randomly,
and
lots of garbage.
Lots of garbage. And by the way, one of the guys digging it up, I think Joe will correct me if I'm wrong, found a newspaper with an article about himself on the cover of it, about him winning a football game when he was 17, and it was the cover of the back page of the paper, which that was probably the most amazing.
It's like a Spielberg movie.
Yeah, it was.
All right, next question, and then I think we're running out of time. We have one more question, and then we'll give away this cartridge. Go ahead, next question, please.
Hi, guys. My name is Kevin. I actually hung out with Howard at a fake landfill in Santa Clarita, California for a day. So hi, good to see you.
How you doing?
I wanted to ask a follow-up on a question that Larry asked Nolan, which might have been intentionally left a little murky just to not blow some of the twists.
Yeah.
But you asked Nolan, and my question is for you, Nolan, why the games were buried in the landfill. I'm wondering why they just weren't recycled, like to some of Howard's point, why... it almost made me feel like it was a publicity stunt, the way you described it, as why they put them there. So I'm just wondering why you think the carts just weren't recycled and why they actually were put in the
movie. This was in the 80s. Recycling hadn't been invented yet.
That's a really good answer.
It feels like it's still not invented sometimes. So is that
But there was a reason, right? They didn't want the cartridges flooding back onto the market, right? I mean, that was always the case and stop me or interrupt me if I'm getting this wrong, but because they were pretty expensive, relatively, those cartridges compared to what the media they come on today, they didn't want a bargain bin filled with 99-cent games that were pulling down the value of the rest of the Atari game. Is that correct?
That's very correct.
All right.
Yeah. All right. So,
thank you.
All right, we're going to have to wrap it up right now. Before we let everybody go, yeah, absolutely. Simon, Jonathan, Mike, Joe, Howard, Nolan, Zach, thank you. They're going to be over at the Xbox Lounge located at the Hyatt Hotel. Just go out the back here and you can kind of follow the flags while they're going to be doing the signing. But first, the winner of this little magic puppy is AbbyNormal_9. Lisa, are you here? There you are.
All right. By the way, great movie reference right there. Young Frankenstein, very nice.
Congratulations. All right, thank you guys for coming. Now remember, the screening is tonight. We'll see you at 7:30. Starts at 8 o'clock.